Let's take a journey back to 2003. Canadian teen sensation Avril Lavigne was topping the charts and turning the music industry upside down. But what if I told you that the Avril Lavigne we know and love might not be the same Avril? What? Did Avril die? Was she replaced by a doppelganger? I'm Joanne McNally, and I'm doing a deep dive into a notorious internet conspiracy. Who replaced Avril Lavigne? Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
So listen, I'm not an actor. I think there's a pretty good chance you're not an actor either. But I tell you what I've noticed about actors over the years, especially theater actors. They talk about King Lear like it's the Mount Everest of acting, like it's the Olympics. And whenever they do, I always nod and go, yeah, of course. But I didn't really understand. Paul Gross is a legendary Canadian actor taking on Lear at Stratford right now. He does the best job I've ever heard at explaining what this role takes from you, why it's so challenging, and what makes it worth it. Paul Gross coming up. I'm Tom Power. You are listening to Q. So when Paul Gross came into the studio, I almost didn't recognize him. Because Paul Gross, if you know him at all, is sort of this, I don't know, clean-cut, handsome fella. You might know him as the Mountie in Due South. You might know him as this, like, curling hoser in Men with Brooms. Whatever you have in your mind about Paul Gross is not what he looked like when he came in. He had this, like, long, scraggly white hair and this even longer, even scragglier gray beard. He was unrecognizable, but it also kind of makes sense because he's currently portraying one of the most challenging roles for an actor, King Lear. Paul is taking on the Shakespearean play at this year's Stratford Festival, the legendary theater festival in Canada. It's his first time back at the festival in over 20 years. As I mentioned just then, I always kind of nod along with actors when they talk about King Lear, about how important and powerful and impossible the role is. But Paul Gross came in and sort of demystified the whole thing. He talks about what the play is really about, why a play like this still matters in 2023, and how to interpret Shakespeare's words. Here's my conversation with Paul Gross. Paul Gross, how are you?
I'm good.
20 years, am I right about that?
Yeah, I know. It seems weird because nothing has changed there. Like, well, there's lots of things that have changed, but the infrastructure of the place is exactly the same. Same carpet, same paint, and the same shower, which I remembered only because it burns you. It has this weird scalding kind of thrust that I thought, oh, this is what it was like 23 years ago. Hold
on, what do you mean? So, what do you mean it burns you?
Like, well, it's acid normal. Rain? It goes like normal temperature, and then suddenly it's just a hose of heat.
And you were like, I'm home.
Yeah.
I'm back, baby.
I'm back.
How did you, I mean, so it opened May 20th, is that right?
29th or 30th.
May 30th.
Yeah.
How did it go? How did opening night go?
I thought it was great. But then I think all of the shows we do are just great. Like I love doing it. And so from my perspective, it's constantly exhilarating. But I think it went really well. I mean, everybody seemed pretty loose and the house seemed happy to be there. And I think it was kind of a big event because it's the first time they've had a real big, what I guess we'd call a more normal opening where there's a lot of hoopla and the place is full. And it was very festive, yeah.
Oh, in the past couple of years, I guess because of COVID, it's been a little bit more muted, or it's been virtual,
or not at all.
Yeah. No. How did you feel before you walked out?
Eager. I don't really normally get nervous, and this one I'm like not. I just really want to get going, and it just seems to take forever for everyone to sit down. And there was some kerfuffle with. I think they had double booked the lieutenant governor's seats. So I think there was some, you could see it on the monitors backstage, some sort of discussion about whether someone would sit on her lap or she'd have to sit on somebody's lap. But they did finally solve that.
No nervousness, no trepidation.
It sort of feels like being a, what are those guys, what are those called? The guys who jump off cliffs and then they have those kind of squirrel suits and they fly?
Wing suits.
Yeah, that's it. That's what it feels like, going down through cliffs. It's really exhilarating.
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, the play just sort of runs away on itself, or I find it does. And so
there's a momentum to the play itself.
Yeah. And you're really just trying to steer through these really narrow canyons and land it somewhere.
A lot of people I've seen write about this with you and have talked about Paul Gross's great return to theater. I'd be curious about Paul Gross's origins with theater. How did you decide on a passion for that world in the first place? Do you remember, was there a moment?
I do, yeah. And it was King Lear.
It wasn't?
Yeah. And it was at Stratford.
No, really? Yeah. Tell me.
I think I was about 12, and I'd kind of liked it, although I'd never really seen that much. But I liked it when we'd do little plays in school, I think. And my mother took me up to Stratford. We were living in Toronto. And it was, I can't remember the year, 72 maybe? Anyway, it was William Hutt doing Lear for the third time. He did it four times in his career, which is crazy. And I don't remember a whole lot about the production, but I remember thinking I'd really like to be part of that world.
Did you feel any finality? Did you feel a period at the end of the sentence when you finally stepped onto this one? Did you say,
I do, yeah. And it's been a strange, so all of it is a little bit strange because I didn't know Bill Hutt at all, really, for the longest time. But Martha, my wife, was very good friends with him, so I became friends with Bill. And we didn't work together until we were doing Slings and Arrows. And in it, I was playing a director who was directing Bill Hutt as Lear.
Yeah.
That all seemed a little meta. But then even more so when Bill kind of confided to me that he was, in fact, dying, just as his character was dying in the show. But would I not tell the producers?
Oh, my Lord.
Much in the same way as his character in the show said, don't tell anybody.
Oh, my Lord.
And just kind of keep an eye on him. Yeah. And it was then that he said, well, when are you going to do it? Do Lear, he meant. I said, I don't know if I ever will.
Well, why not?
I don't know. I mean, to be honest, at the time, I thought I was too young. And I when I started talking to Anthony Cimolino, who's the artistic director of Stratford, I thought, am I a little young for that? Oh, no, wait. No, you're not. you're actually the right age for this.
But you're talking to Bill Hutt, and he says, when are you going to do your Lear? Mm-hmm. And you say, I'm not sure I ever will.
Yeah. I do think about him. Just about every time I go on.
What do you think about?
It's pretty vague, but it's just a feeling of, well, you were here, and now I'm here. And you know that the floor has not changed, so it's filled with all of the marks of every actor that's ever been on it.
How much was Shakespeare a part of your sort of early days as a theater actor, either in school or otherwise?
Well, a fair bit in school. You do a lot of it. I went to University of Alberta, which was a terrific school, and we did quite a bit of it, actually. And then one of the first professional job I had was playing in Midsummer Night's Dream, which was fantastic, in Edmonton. And I did a fair bit of it when I was younger, but then I had this long hiatus where I went off and ended up doing television and film. And I would come back to the theater infrequently. but I always had a feeling for the verse. I feel really at home with it. And it's actually quite easy to do. And this is not a weird thing to say, but Lear is difficult, but it's also easy, if that makes any sense. The lines are, what he has to say is so perfect you can't imagine that there could be any other possible way to say it. So it stays with you. It gets filled up quickly with your imagination, and you just inhabit it. So you're not having to struggle to reach for things. It's there. And I find the verse, it just carries you, it carries me along. Wherever I turn, it'll go with me. And
when I read it, I might read it as often I do when I read Shakespeare, dense or inscrutable, or, you know, but you're saying that when you speak it, the way you approach it, the way it sort of comes to you, it couldn't be any other way, and you see sort of how perfect and beautiful that it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of it's a bit distant now just because the language has obviously changed a lot in 400 years, but words like falchion we don't use very often anymore.
Yeah, not enough.
It's a good word.
Not to put you on the spot here, like, is there a favorite piece of verse from the play? Is there something that you speak and you go, oh, wow, I can't believe someone wrote that?
Oh, there's so many of them.
Come on, do you got one?
Well, poor naked wretches, wheresoe'er you are, bide the pelting of this pitiless storm. That one is crazy beautiful.
Why?
It's just this odd little jewel that's kind of about two-thirds of the way through.
Yeah, can you set up for people like where it comes in into the...
Sure, it's about... Lear has lost his kingdom. He's gone out in the storm. He's he's beginning to really come unhinged, and there's a hovel that they want, his cohorts want to get him into, where he can be out of the elements. And he says, no, you guys go in first, I'll pray. And then he delivers this prayer, which is that, which is absolutely staggeringly beautiful. And it's also the first time we see him aware of his subjects, of the people that he's responsible for, and that he has never really taken care of them.
We'll be right back.
One of the best shows of the year, according to Apple, Amazon, and Time, is back for another round. This season, we're diving deep into some of McCartney's most beloved songs. Yesterday, Band on the Run, Hey Jude. And McCartney's favourite song in his entire catalogue, Here, There, and Everywhere. Listen to Season 2 of McCartney, A Life in Lyrics, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I think the beautiful thing about Shakespeare, and Paul, I don't know anything about acting, and I wasn't an actor before I did this, and I still haven't really. I've acted twice in my life.
How were you?
Poor.
Oh.
I did.
Is that on tape?
Oh, yeah, buddy. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's both times as myself, by the way.
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah. I was Tom Power as Tom Power.
And you were bad.
Still somehow.
That's pretty weird.
What does that tell you?
I don't know.
Let's not.
We'll talk about that.
That's something to bring to the therapist, if you ask me. But my favorite parts of getting to talk to actors, specifically Shakespearean actors, is when they describe the role as sort of a vessel, an emotional vessel that they can put themselves in. Now, I'm giving you permission to get a bit grand here because I want you to. What did you bring to it? What did you want to bring to it? What did you see in Lear that you wanted to?
I didn't start with something I thought that I should do. I just started with the play. So okay. I just read it over and on. And I had months to get ready for this. So I read it, many months. I don't know how many times I read it. Then the lines started sticking in my head, and I have a place outside in the country, and I would walk in the fields with my dogs, and I'd yell at them as if they were Goneril and Regan, and they were very good scene mates. They're very good at it.
You know, better than me, probably.
Yeah, they get really excited.
And they're only playing themselves, too.
That's right. And then it just, what I find is that, and it was kind of the same thing with Hamlet, it starts to talk to you, or it starts pulling things out of you that you didn't even think of particularly, but it starts to show up. So look at what I think Shakespeare meant. That's really what it is, the kind of archaeology of that, of him. And so never going into a scene with an assumption about what it is, or, oh, it should be like this, or, oh, it's that. Is just keep looking at what I think the author meant, and then that start rehearsing with that, and then that gets more and more informed as you go along. And there are little things that Shakespeare does that I'm getting, that I'm more used to now, or I'm quite accustomed to, or you can see certain setups and what he's trying to set up and what the payout is. And it's not necessarily a joke. It can be a really profound emotion, but he'll set it up with something, and then he leads you to it.
Like what?
An example of it would be he encounters his old minister, the Earl of Gloucester, and Gloucester's been blinded, and this is happening out in the storm, and well, in the heath. And Lear's kind of going along, and he's quite batty, and he's jumping around in his head, and Gloucester says, he recognizes him as the king and says, let me kiss your hand. And Lear says, well, let me wipe it first. Now, that's a setup because it's funny. And then the next line, part of the line is, it smells of mortality. And that's the heavy hit. And that's what, you could just feel the whole house shift a little bit because they know it's going somewhere. And it is. It goes wild for a little while, and then it gets to Lear saying, I know who you are. I recognize you. Which he didn't seem to. And it's one of the most unbelievably emotional moments in the play.
And it's there. Yeah. It's there. It was there. Shakespeare gave that to you.
Yeah.
You didn't have to find it.
No.
You just had to, I love what you said, you just had to recognize what he already gave you.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that was my big, if there's any big discovery, it's like bad to do this because it's really the PR. If you keep saying it's impossible, it'd be great. But I don't think it is. It's the play is massive, but the cosmology of it, the bellows that are blowing the universe through the play, are not on my shoulders. That's Shakespeare is doing that.
Yeah, because it does have a mythology around it. Like, even the way we're talking about it is not the way we talk about Macbeth. It's not the way we talk about A Midsummer Night's Dream. There is the sort of, like, heft of Lear. And it gets discussed when someone... I mean, you taking on Lear was hushed and discussed. But in all seriousness, you know, yeah. It does have this sort of heft to it that other plays don't seem to.
Well, I think that's the play itself. And then that gets confused with the part. I mean, the part is phenomenally difficult, but it's not impossible. It's a part. It's one moment to the next moment to the next moment. And if you can string all of those together with a degree of truth and authenticity, then Shakespeare does the rest of his work and people are wrecked by the end of the show.
Do you have to be old? Like you said, I might be too young. When you say that, like, it takes the totality of you, it takes all of you to take this on. Is there something to this is not a role, not just even physically, but this is not a role you can take on early-ish in your acting life?
Well, I don't know. People have. I mean, Brian Cox played it in a production that...
Pretty early on?
I think he was 40.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think he started acting when he was 3 years old. So, you know.
Well, he's born.
Yeah, and he was
40.
Born, yeah. Angry and, you know. But you know what
no,
I'm asking.
No, but I mean, right? I think people have played it in a bunch of different ages. I'm actually slightly older than most of the Lears were who have played it in recent years at Stratford.
But I'm curious. Like, do you feel like it's do you feel like it's taking the totality of sort of your acting years to get to this point where you can
do this
role?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it takes. You have to know a lot in order to do it. I think, or you have to be comfortable with a lot, because the path of his journey is quite extraordinary. I mean, he starts at the absolute apex of power and then just disintegrates, and it takes a long time for that to happen. It's more encompassing in many ways his path than a lot of other parts. And the demands physically are big.
Yeah.
Vocally, it's really huge. There's a lot of big stuff. And we only do a few performances a week, so I'd be fine. I couldn't do it eight shows. I'd blow my throat out, I think. So.
Are you tired afterwards?
Yeah. But it's a great feeling of tired. And I was talking with Tom McCamus, who played it recently at Soul Pepper in Toronto, and we were trying to talk about what it felt like. He said, well, the only way I can describe it is that it just felt like you feel after a really long, good, hard day of skiing. Okay, yeah, that's exactly it. We just feel great, empty, but fabulous. Whereas Hamlet would make me suicidal. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it just grinds you around on the boulders you have inside yourself. It's not. It's like going to the world's meanest therapist. But Lear is sort of like getting, you feel like you've been burned clean. It's really quite, and he's almost not at all self-reflective. So he isn't mulling around about whether he's maybe done something wrong. It's everybody else that has done stuff that's bad.
Let's listen to some of it. Take a listen to this.
Thy truth, then, be thy dower. For by the sacred radiance of the sun, by all the operation of the orbs from whom we do exist and cease to be, here I display all my paternal care, propinquity, and property of blood, and as a stranger to my heart and me, hold thee from this forever, my sometime daughter.
It's my guest Paul Gross is King Lear in Stratford's new production. What's going on there?
It's just a domestic dispute, Tom. No, for those who don't know the play, this is the beginning of it, or more or less the beginning. There is another little scene that introduces it. But Lear enters with his court, and he's decided he's going to divide his kingdom because he's now, I think he's just tired. He's tired of running it all. And so he sets up this loopy love test where he has three daughters and each in turn has to proclaim their love for him. And that on the basis of how well they've done this, they will be allocated a certain amount of the kingdom. And so the first two daughters play along, and it's way over the top how much they love him, but he's quite pleased with that. And then he turns to his favorite daughter, whose name is Cordelia, and says, okay, you speak. And she says, what can you say? And she says, nothing. And this goes on for a bit. And then he loses his nut, just goes and banishes her, basically. He forces her to marry one of the two guys who've been courting her, and that's the king of France, and go away, leave my kingdom. Kicks out his best guy and storms off. So it's a good beginning.
I want a series called Paul Gross Summarizes Shakespeare, because it's good. You're good. Yeah, yeah, you're good, man. My mom was an English teacher. I want this series. I want a TikTok series where you go, okay, Paul Gross, what happened to what happened in Richard III? Oh, yeah, yeah. What happened to Macbeth? Oh, it was because of this.
And then this happened. Then there were these witches.
It is a quite a moment for King Lear. As you mentioned, that the HBO show Succession, people were reading King Lear to get an idea of how the show might end.
What's Roman going to do next?
Well, to be fair, they were reading it. They were. I was reading something the other day that the Google search numbers for King Lear skyrocketed during the last season of Succession.
Oh, that's so funny.
Because there was something, and I think the word Succession comes up a lot in the program notes for this version of King Lear.
Well, it is all about Succession, and so much of Shakespeare. And of course, and it would have been a topic of enormous concern for people in Shakespeare's time, because they just dodged a bomb with Elizabeth dying without any children, let alone a male heir. And there wasn't any huge scuffle, and they lucked out and got James from Scotland, who came in. When this play was done, he would have been on the throne. But yeah, I mean, it's dangerous. If the inheritance is screwed up, all sorts of stuff can happen. And therefore Succession.
Well, what it tells me is that we've always been interested in it. We've always been interested in the greed and avarice and tragedies and successes of a ruling class. Does working on this show, whether the ruling class be a monarchy, or, you know, whether the ruling class be the people who control the newspapers and, you know, and the TV stations. Me. No, the people who control the TV shows and the newspapers. Why do you think we are so taken by that, working on a show like this?
Well, I think because our lives are influenced by those people who are, you know, own the media empires and run the country.
Are the kings and the queens.
And are the kings and the queens of our time. And yeah, we're fascinated by it because we'd like to think that it might work out so that things are okay for us, you know, and stuff's going on with a crazy Rogers family. You think, really? Can we just take this over and nationalize it? Because this is silly. And a lot that happens, I mean, I think Elon Musk is a great example of, you just make money. That's all you need to do. You don't need to try to drive the world.
You see something in Lear like that, that our affection or our interest or our sort of perverted love for the play is related to the fact that these people, these Lears, are around us all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they are around us all the time. And when their actions are sort of whimsical or capricious, or a lot of people get affected by that. Yeah, so I think, I'm fascinated by that guy. He's a weirdo. And isn't he, once again, the richest guy?
Mm-hmm.
But what's he doing trying to fiddle around in politics? Get out of that. Although, I don't know. I look at our political slate and I kind of think, well, you might as well get in. It's not it's not like there seems to be a pretty low bar for entry.
But so. you see it through Lear. You see that someone, you know, the quest for ultimate power is a seductive one.
Mm-hmm.
And one that can ultimately...
But more importantly, the possession of ultimate power requires a responsibility that an awful lot of people who arrive at it don't have.
What's the most fulfilling part about doing it?
Well, as I usually find doing theater, the most fulfilling thing is if that audience is with you. And when they are and that place is full, it's just the most magical theater to be in. And the feeling is crazy. You have this great, long, complicated conversation with 1,800 people. And it's nice to hear people crying at the end. I mean, it's not nice they're crying, but it's nice to be able to hear it.
I've never been.
You've never been there?
No.
When are you coming?
I'm going to come out.
Well, when?
I don't know. When is it? You're only doing like one show a week, aren't you?
Two or three.
I'm going to come out.
But we're doing them until October, so you've got to.
I'm here. I've never been to Stratford.
You've got to come. It is the greatest theater in North America.
Why?
that space is, I don't know, bizarrely magical. It's easy. It feels like home. It's the easiest place to work on. It never feels anything but the easiest place to be.
Thanks for coming in. Thanks for talking to me about acting.
Yeah, that was nice. Thanks.
As a folk musician, I got to tell you, my knowledge of acting is low. My knowledge of anything that's not dulcimer-based is pretty low, to be honest. But I love the way that Paul Gross demystified acting for me there. It took me a little while to understand what he was talking about. Well, once I did, I can't wait to go see it. I can't wait to go out to Stratford to see Paul Gross in King Lear. He's going to be doing that show until October 29th, and I'll see you there. Paul Gross, join me in studio. That's it for this episode of Q. If you have some time, I recommend you check out the other episode we put up today. It's a conversation with Leah Simone Bowen, who, if you're a fan of CBC podcasts, you might know from Podcast Playlist and The Secret Life of Canada. She is staging an opera that was thought to be lost. And not just any opera, but an opera written by Scott Joplin. You know, Scott Joplin, who wrote The Entertainer, and The Maple Leaf Rag. I won't sing that one. Anyway, Scott Joplin didn't live to see this opera called Treemonisha performed, and it was thought to be lost. And Leah's going to talk about what it means to her to be bringing it back. All right, go check it out. I'm Tom Power. Later on.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.